Good evening. Air raid sirens were heard again here tonight as Kyiv deals with the fact that driving Russian ground troops away from the city does not make it immune from Russian air attack, namely the cruise missile strike last night. When we left you, reports were that 10 people had been wounded in that attack. Today, rescuers removed a body from the rubble of the high-rise apartment that was hit. A woman named Vera Hyrich, a Ukrainian journalist with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. She was 54 years old and is the 23rd member of the media to be killed since the Russian invasion began. Russia says the missile was aimed at a nearby defense plant. It landed not far from where UN Secretary General Guterres was at the time. Kyiv's mayor tonight called it Vladimir Putin's raised middle finger to the Secretary General. You'll hear more from my conversation with Mayor Klitschko in the program. We also learned more details today in the death of American and former Marine Willie Joseph Cancel, killed fighting alongside Ukrainian troops. The White House today offering condolences and cautioning Americans against coming here to fight. Just a short time ago, Cancel's mother spoke to CNN.
He believes in what they were fighting for. It just was something that hit to his heart, and you know, he knew they needed help, and it was just something that he felt that he could help in because he had the experience and the training and the knowledge to go and help them.
We'll have more on that coming up, including the questions it raises, like what contracting company hired him to come here to Ukraine and who might have been paying that company. As for the fighting itself, Russian forces continue to pound the south and east of the country, but without a great deal of forward progress. Outside one city, they appear to be moving forward. Sloviansk, new images tonight of a recently blown up railway bridge, possibly taken down by Ukrainian units fighting a tactical withdrawal, something we've seen several times here before. Then there was this, after a week of thinly veiled nuclear threats from the Kremlin and the latest attack on Kyiv with the UN Secretary General nearby, Pentagon spokesman John Kirby's emotional answer when asked if the Defense Department considers Vladimir Putin a rational actor.
I'm not going to go into the psychology of Vladimir Putin. It's hard to look at what he's doing in Ukraine, what his forces are doing in Ukraine, and think that any ethical, moral individual could justify that. It's difficult to look at the It's difficult to look at some of the images and imagine that any well-thinking, serious, mature leader would do that. So I can't talk to his psychology, but I think we can all speak to his depravity.
A lot to bring you in the hour ahead. Reporting for us tonight from Washington, CNN's Alex Marquardt on the Willie Cancel story, CNN's Matt Rivers on the Russian missile strikes, and in the capital of neighboring Moldova, Randy Kaye. First, we go to Alex Marquardt. So, Alex, what more are you learning tonight?
Well, Anderson, the Biden administration itself has not confirmed the death of Willie Cancel. His mother, most of what we're learning is coming from his mother. President Biden did acknowledge Cancel today, saying that it's very sad that he left a baby behind. What we do know from the Cancel family is that he was 22 years old, former Marine. He felt this call to go and join the fight in Ukraine. He had a wife. He left behind a seven-month-old child. He had been working in Tennessee as a corrections officer, but his mother also says that he joined a private contracting company. So when the war started, this contracting company asked if anyone would go and fight in Ukraine, and he raised his hand. Before going to Ukraine, his mother said, he traveled back to New York to see his wife, his child, and his father. And then went out to California for 24 hours to see his mother. And then he went over and he went into Ukraine around mid-March. His mother says that's about 2.5 to 3 weeks after the fighting started. And they were able to keep some kind of contact with him as he fought, not very much, as you can imagine. The last time they spoke with him was just a week ago on Thursday. They were able to FaceTime with him. He introduced some members of his unit. In the following days, they texted a little bit. He said, I'm safe. I love you. And the last they heard from him was last Sunday before he died, Anderson.
Did his mom say what company he was working for and who was paying him, or give any indication on how many contractors there might be in Ukraine or working alongside him?
She wouldn't say, didn't say what contracting company he worked for, whether he was being paid, how he was being paid. As you heard in that clip there, he was drawn to this cause. He wanted to go fight for the underdog. His mother also told CNN, she spoke with our colleague Ellie Kaufman, that he worried that the fight would spill over, that it would go beyond Ukraine's borders, and that American troops would eventually have to go and fight. But he was, you know, convinced that this was the right thing to do. It's highly possible, even probable, Anderson, that even if he went with a private company, that he then went on to join this international legion that Ukraine has set up. You'll remember that in the early days of the war, the earliest days, Ukraine recognized how hard this fight was going to be and set up what they called an international legion, calling on anyone and everyone who wanted to come and fight for Ukraine. And people did. Foreigners poured across the border into Ukraine to go and fight as volunteers. But to put a number on that is impossible. It's very murky. The Ukrainians did say early on that some 20,000 foreign volunteers and vets had signed up from 52 different countries. But Anderson, it's unclear how many actually went on to join the fight.
And the White House today just again said essentially don't come to Ukraine to fight.
They did. They expressed their condolences to the Cancel family. They said, this is White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. She said she understands why Americans would want to go over there. Americans are also inside Ukraine training Ukrainian fighters. The White House saying they understand that, but they do not want Americans inside Ukraine. She said that if you want to help, please try to find another way, whether it's with an aid group or an NGO. But the message from the Biden administration to Americans is very clear. Please don't go to Ukraine. It's too dangerous. Anderson.
Yeah. Alex Marquardt, appreciate it. Thank you. Now, Mariupol and the hundreds of fighters and civilians holding out and sheltering beneath the city's enormous steelmaking complex. Now, earlier this week, we got our first look at the very difficult living conditions there inside the plant. One woman saying they haven't seen daylight for weeks, children crying all the time, food and water running out. Now, Mariupol's mayor says the Russians have been bombing a makeshift hospital inside the facility, wounding, he says, more than 600 people. Joining us tonight is Yuri Rzhinkov, CEO of the company that owns the plant. Mr. Rzhinkov, I appreciate you being with us. Are you in contact with people at the plant or those who've escaped? What are they telling you about the conditions inside?
Well, unfortunately, we're not in contact with the people at the plant for more than 3 weeks now since the connection broke up. But we are meeting the people who get out of the plant, and we're meeting them right on the outskirts of Mariupol, trying to provide them with humanitarian aid like food, water, shelter, and then trying to evacuate them to Zaporozhye, where we set up a rehabilitation center with the psychiatrist, with the medics, and so on. They're telling us it's a humanitarian disaster there. The city is being destroyed. Basically, a beautiful, thriving city was turned into a concentration camp by the Russians in less than 2 months. You can say it's genocide, which is happening there.
How difficult is it for them to escape on their own? Because we know that plans for these civilian corridors have been mostly unsuccessful. Buses really haven't. Only a few buses have ever gotten out. Some people in personal vehicles early on were able to get out. But it's very, very difficult.
It is very difficult. We've been trying to send a humanitarian convoy with the buses, with the food and medicine into the city and try to get as many people as we can out of the city from the beginning, literally, of this siege. But every time we did this, the Russians start shooting. So never this convoy got into the city. The people started to get out of the city on their own cars, even on foot. I mean, I have a terrible story of one of our employees who had to leave the city and walk through the minefields with his pregnant wife for more than 30 kilometers. Actually, as he got into safety, his wife gave birth the next day, and fortunately the child and the parents are okay, but what they had to live through is terrible.
This is, for those who don't know, and obviously Russian troops who are there are well aware of what this plant is like. This is an enormous facility. Can you give it just a sense of the size of it? And there's much of it underground. Is that correct?
There are lots of fakes about actually the underground part of the facility. It is a large steel mill. The capacity of steel mill used to be over 7 million tons in the Soviet times. Lately, it was producing about 4.5 million tons of steel a year. Its area, it's about 1,000 hectares. Employed 11,000 people at the beginning of this aggression. And yes, obviously, there are lots of underground facilities there. Every shop would have an underground shelter, bomb shelter, which was built during the Cold War and would temporarily house about two shifts of the employees of the mill, which is about 4,000 people could hide into shelters at any given moment in time. We actually stocked those shelters with food and water enough for about 2-3 weeks just before the war. That gave the possibility for the people to stay there for a while. But as you can imagine, this runs out. It's almost 2 months now. Regarding the tunneling system, which has been so much discussed in the press, there are tunnels, of course, like under any industrial facility, but those are not military tunnels, and those are not kind of tunnels meant for people to move about. Those are sewage tunnels or cabling tunnels, and they are not connecting the shelters. They're just the sewage system under the plant.
Vladimir Putin is obviously watching this situation. He, you know, told his general on television a few days ago he wanted to be seen as saying, you know, don't go in, don't try to take the plant, just surround it so that not even a fly can escape. What is your message for Vladimir Putin about what he and his forces are doing to the people in Mariupol?
Well, the message is simple. Don't make it any worse than it already is. Let the civilians out. Let the people get out of the plant safely into the safe place.
Yuri Rozhenkov, I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll have more on the aftermath of the Russian missile strike in Kyiv and my conversation with the city's mayor, Vitaly Klitschko. Later, the remarkable young woman who documented what it was like to live in Kharkiv under nearly constant bombardment and her escape with her family. Now that it's even worse and her dad is now there, how is he and how is she holding up ahead? At the top of the program, we recounted the mayor of Kyiv's characterization of the Russian cruise missile strike on the city last night, which killed a Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe journalist and came close to where UN Secretary General Guterres was at the time. He called it Vladimir Putin's raised middle finger at the Secretary General. That's not all Vitaly Klitschko had to say. Our conversation shortly, but some background first from CNN's Matt Rivers on the attack that shook the city last night and leaves it shaken tonight.
It had been weeks of relative quiet in Kyiv, but a couple of bangs and a plume of black smoke quickly changed that. Ukraine and Russia both confirming cruise missiles were fired into a central district of Kyiv on Thursday evening, mere miles away from where the UN Secretary General had just wrapped up a meeting with President Zelensky. Rescuers worked through the night, and in the morning, a clearer picture emerged about what happened, with this apartment complex shredded by shrapnel, leaving those in the neighborhood shaken. This wall saved my life, she says. Otherwise, it would have been the end. There was a lot of fire. I could see everything was burning. I was so scared. It was horror. She says she only survived because she wasn't sitting next to the window. Her son Alexei's hands bloodied. He says a clap and a blast, then panic. That's it. I didn't see it until later. I saw my hand was covered in blood. Mother and son survived, while others affected by the strike did not. 54-year-old Vera Hirich, a Ukrainian journalist, lived here, having just returned to her home about a week ago. No one had heard from her all night, so friends kept trying to call her. Her ringing cell phone led rescuers to her body this morning. I have no words, says this friend. No tears left. I have no energy to cry. Only a few days ago, she was asking how she could help me because my house burned down, and now no one can help her.
Russia's Ministry of Defense says they were aiming for a factory right nearby here that is one of Ukraine's top producers of air-to-air guided missiles as well as aircraft parts. We can't show you that factory due to Ukrainian law. The factory was damaged in the strike, but so was that apartment complex just behind me. Yet another example of Russia targeting places with supposed military relevance, but killing ordinary civilians in the process.
Vera's body was taken out of the building midday on Friday. The victim of an attack President Zelensky said proves, quote, that one cannot relax yet. One cannot think that the war is over. We still need to fight.
And Matt Rivers is here with me. I understand there's been a new development. Some people were arrested at the site.
Yeah, so this, what we know is that Ukraine is always nervous about anything that could help Russia better target its strikes, get a better idea of the results of its strikes. And so they say that they arrested two people on the scene that authorities say were acting suspiciously, actually taking pictures of the damage of that site. And when they searched their phones, they say they were members of various separatist pro-Russian Telegram groups. They had contacts in Russia. And so what they're saying is that they're going to continue that investigation to make sure that these two people are not actively working for the Russians here in Ukraine. We should add, you know, being a part of a Telegram group or having contacts in Russia does not make you a Russian spy. But this is something clearly the Ukrainians are worried about enough to make this information public.
I mean, security is still, people are very security conscious here. And just in terms of reporting, they're concerned about giving away locations of strikes for this very reason, to help. They don't want to help Russians target better.
Yeah, and they are very strict with journalists as well. I mean, telling us we can't even show the military facility that was damaged as a result of this strike. We were just across the street from it, essentially, and yet we couldn't even show it because of that martial law.
Yeah, Matt Rivers, appreciate it. Also, I know authorities here have urged residents not to return because of the continuing danger. They don't want people rushing back.
Yeah, and this is something we've heard from authorities for a while now, because as life has returned, not to normal, but more normal than it was in the beginning of the war, when there were literal bombs falling not far from where we are, you know, people have started to come back. They want to restart their lives, and it's an understandable sentiment, but authorities have said, look, it's not safe yet, and they're pointing to these missile strikes as a, you know, example of why it's not totally safe to return.
Yeah, Matt, appreciate it. Matt Sure. Rivers, very much. I spent yesterday with Elena Ganes and her three young children. She is, above all, studying resilience, as are so many people here. The man you're about to meet again, who you've probably become well acquainted with by now, is a study in defiance. Vitaly Klitschko, mayor of Kyiv and former world heavyweight boxing champion. I spoke to him shortly before airtime. Were you surprised by the missile strike yesterday?
It's no surprise right now for me. We expect everything what is said. Actually, it's very unusual in normal life. If we're talking about Russia, no rules. After visiting in General Secretary of United Nations, after the visiting Moscow, right now everybody knows he's coming to Kyiv. And the same day when General Secretary meet the President of Ukraine, the rockets attack to our hometown.
It seems like the Russians are sending messages with their bombings sometimes.
I mean, it's a message, I guess, it's a message, middle finger from Russia.
It's a middle finger.
Yeah.
They did it when Secretaries Austin and Blinken left on the train. They bombed the trains in the West. Secretary General of the UN was here yesterday. They bombed when he was still here.
Yeah, it's a signal. My opinion is no respect. It's a middle finger for everybody.
You went to the scene of the blast. What was it like?
It's actually dramatic to see the destroyed building depressed people.
There's a 25-story residential building. The first two floors, they say, were damaged by fire. At least 10 people.
We was very happy. It's a brand new building. It's not, people doesn't have a time to move. But it's 20 meters left or 20 meters right. It can kill hundreds of people. And that's why we are lucky. Just what has been lucky? It's destroyed. This apartment building is destroyed. Just one people has died, 10 injured. We're lucky because it can be much more damages. Much more people dead.
A few weeks ago, you had said that people shouldn't rush back. People who had moved away shouldn't rush back necessarily. Is that still the case? Are you cautious about people returning?
We can't forbid them to come. Yes, of course, I understand everyone wants to come back to hometown. The last week was pretty quiet and people moved back. But my advice to anyone to stay in much more safety place, because we are responsible for life of the people, for safety. And it's any second, any minutes, any hours, the rockets, Russian rockets can launch every place in our hometown. And it's not secret. Kyiv was target and still target from Russians.
Do you think it's possible that they would resume daily attacks on Kyiv, that they would continue to try to come back to Kyiv to try to remove the leadership?
Definitely. Definitely. It's the main goal. The Russians never believe in Russians, first of all, and they always have some explanation, but the main goal is to occupy Kyiv.
So even though the fighting has moved to the east, the emphasis of the fighting has moved to the east, Kyiv is still under threat?
Kyiv is still the target.
When you see the fighting in the east, what concerns you? How do you think it's going?
I hope we keep finger crossed for our soldier, for our army, and we have to defend our homeland. Actually, Ukrainian army destroyed the mythos about the strongest army in the world, the Russian army. I as former fighter, I can explain to you, it's not a matter how big are you, how strong are you. It's very important, the will and spirit for every fighter. It's simple explanation. Right now, the Russian soldier fighting for the money. Our soldier defend our families and our children, the future of our children. Do you see the difference to die for the money or die as you defend your children?
And that will to fight, that makes all the difference.
Yeah, the will to fight is make huge difference between the Russian soldier and Ukrainian.
One of the things the Secretary General was trying to do was get agreement from Russia on actual real humanitarian corridors to get people out of Mariupol. Do you think that will ever really happen? Do you think Russia will ever agree to that?
Russians are unpredictable, and that's why the to make predictions what Russians accept or not, it's pretty difficult. And I hope we need to take the people from Mariupol. It's very important, and they all, our partners, everybody in the world, every rule have also. Every war has some rules, and to evacuate civilians from Mariupol is very important for us.
Are you optimistic?
Always.
You believe that Ukraine will win?
Definitely.
Mr. Mayor, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Vitaly Klitschko. And yes, he is very big. He's enormous. Vladimir Putin now says he'll attend the G20 summit, a top economic meeting for world leaders later this year. President Biden reacted to that today, but will he and the U.S. allies stay home? Potential showdown between the two leaders next. President Biden's management of U.S. involvement in this war extends beyond the aid and arms and intelligence being sent to Ukraine. Today, Russia indicated that later this year, Vladimir Putin would attend one of the top economic meetings for world leaders, the G20 summit in Indonesia. A lot of time, certainly, between now and then, but already the White House is trying to determine how to respond and whether even to attend while keeping a united front among allies across the world. Joined now by our chief White House correspondent, Caitlin Collins. So this is a strange situation. I mean, Vladimir Putin was invited to this G20 meeting by the president of Indonesia, which is hosting the meeting. Was there any pressure from the United States or NATO to not extend that invitation, do we know?
Well, so the White House says their understanding of how this all went down, Anderson, is that Indonesia extended this invitation to Russia before the invasion of Ukraine had actually happened. But I think what's notable is that they have not rescinded the invitation since this has happened. And they don't seem poised to do so because they put out a statement today saying that there needs to be unity among these G20 nations, of course, the leading industrialized nations in the world, saying that they don't need to be split. So it doesn't seem like they are about to change their mind on this invitation. And so that's what puts the United States and President Biden in a weird spot of making this decision of whether they go and are in the same room as President Putin at a lot of these meetings. Because, of course, you know how these summits go. There's often these family photos with all the world leaders in them at the beginning. They have many summits, a lot of one-on-ones often between these world leaders. And, of course, it would be the first time that Biden had seen Putin in person, face-to-face, since this invasion started. And so I think that's what the White House is weighing. What do they do here? Do they boycott, or does President Biden go?
What does the White House see as the risks of President Biden showing up to the meeting versus the risk of declining to attend and protest?
I think the number one risk is giving Putin this world stage, appearing on the world stage with him, given, of course, what he's done. And the fact that so much has changed since the last time, not only that they spoke, but since President Biden and President Putin saw each other when they had this huge summit, of course, last summer, about a year ago from now in Geneva, where they met for several hours one on one. And since then, the relationship has deteriorated to a point where Russia experts say they haven't seen the relations between the United States and Russia this low in decades. And of course, Biden has called Putin a war criminal. He's said that he's committing genocide there. And so I think that is that. That's what they're weighing. But also when it comes to the risks of not going, the White House still seems to think the most likely scenario right now is that Biden does still go. And of course, he has said that Russia should be removed from the G20. Anderson, that's very unlikely to happen because it has to be a consensus decision. China gets a decision there. They're like not likely to push Russia out of this. And so he said instead Ukraine should also be invited. They have been invited, though. It's not clear that they have accepted that invitation.
All right. Galen Collins, appreciate it. We'll keep following. Coming up, Transnistria. Probably never heard of it before, maybe a few weeks ago, but there's now a lot of talk about this strange breakaway region possibly being the next front in the war. Miranda Kay got as close as she could to the border today of Transnistria before being turned back. Her report is next. Another place we're keeping an eye on tonight is along Ukraine's southwest border. It's a place you may not have heard of before this war, a breakaway region of Ukraine's neighbor Moldova called Transnistria. You can see it there on a map. It's been home to Russian troops for decades. Ukraine says Thursday it was strengthening security along its border with Transnistria after a series of unexplained explosions there earlier this week. Russia's condemned the attacks, blamed Ukraine. Ukraine says they believe the attacks were staged by Russia as a pretext, perhaps, to open a new front in the war. CNN's Randy Kay is in Moldova tonight after venturing to the border of that breakaway republic today.
We drove here from the capital of Moldova to see just how close we could get to Transnistria. That's that breakaway republic that sits on the border of Moldova and Ukraine. That shared border is about 250 miles long, and Transnistria is about the size of Rhode Island. There are about 500,000 people living on that tiny strip of land, many of whom do speak Russian. There's also believed to be about 1,500 Russian forces there. Those are believed, according to Russia, to be peacekeeping forces. But as we saw, many of them are manning those border crossings. That bridge in the distance behind me goes to the city of Dubasari in Transnistria. It's one of five bridges that connects Moldova, where we are, to Transnistria. We did drive up there hoping to get closer, but once we saw a Russian armored vehicle and the Russian troops, we turned around quickly. Some Moldovans who we've spoken with who have crossed over say there are police everywhere there in Transnistria, and it feels very much like the Soviet Union. The reason that Transnistria could be so key is because it could be just what Russia needs to expand the war from Ukraine into Moldova. A Russian commander recently raised concerns the army planned to control southern Ukraine and open a land corridor stretching to Transnistria.
Randy Kay joins us now from Moldova's capital. So when you were there at the border, were the Russian troops there? It looked like they were watching you pretty much the whole time.
Yeah, they certainly were, Anderson. They kept their eyes on us. They had those binoculars. They seemed to be passing them back and forth to each other. They were chatting amongst themselves and looking at us the whole time as we were there on the side of the road taking some video of that area. And they also seemed to change position while we were there. When we first pulled up, One of those troops was actually on the Moldova side. And then by the time we left, they had moved back onto the bridge. But there are five bridges that connect Moldova to Transnistria. And that is so unnerving for people here, certainly in the capital of Chisinau, where we are right now, because it's only about 45 minutes away from here. So the citizens are certainly concerned. And there's about 450,000 Ukrainian refugees that came here. There's about 100,000 of them left here. They certainly don't want to see Transnistria and Moldova next on Vladimir Putin's list, Anderson.
Are people in Moldova concerned about a possible Russian incursion into Moldova?
Yeah, we did get a real sense of concern, Anderson. We spoke with a former U.S. Marine. He seems very concerned about Russia invading here. We also spoke with a volunteer organization that is working with the refugees. They're already making contingency plans to get their people out if they need to. And of course, we heard from the president of Moldova earlier this week saying that she thinks those unexplained attacks in Transnistria are just an attempt by Russia to escalate what's the tension in this ongoing war. She also said that she condemns any attempt to involve Moldova in actions that could threaten peace here. And it's important to note, Anderson, that Moldova is not a member of NATO. It's not a member of the European Union. It considers itself neutral, but that may not be enough for Vladimir Putin, Anderson.
Randy Kaye, I appreciate it. Thank you. We get perspective now from retired Army Lieutenant General and CNN military analyst Mark Hertling. General Hertling, a senior U.S. defense official, said that today that Russian forces are making, quote, some incremental, uneven, slow advances to the southeast and southwest of Izium. The Russians are trying to advance on a number of different fronts, obviously. Can you just talk a little bit about why this area south of Izium is so crucial to the Russian strategy?
Well, it's a critical crossroads, Anderson, because it has various road junctions that go north, south, east, and west, number one. It also has railroads coming out of the town of Izium. Izium's a relatively small town, about 40,000 in the population. But it also, as importantly, has a river that runs through it. And the Russians need to secure that riverbank and put bridgeheads over that river. There's not many bridges. There's two in the city of Izium itself. So in order to get forces from the east to the west, which they will need to attempt to surround the Ukrainian army, they need to control a couple of those key cities. So the fighting there is very intense. It is one of the so-called shoulders of the envelopment movement that Russia is trying to do, both from the north and from the south, of the Ukrainian forces fighting along the Donbas front. So it's that positional advantage, getting key terrain, which is always important. And the Russians are putting a whole lot of forces from their eastern and central military districts, their combined arms armies, into those areas. They have gained some things. They have gained a little bit of terrain. But every time the Russians conduct an artillery barrage, as we talked about yesterday, and then follow up with forces going into those areas, what they find is when it's the artillery stops and the forces go in, the Ukrainian forces will be able to push them back. But this is going to be a somewhat horrific fight for that shoulder, that northern shoulder around Izium, and the control of the rivers and the roads in that area.
Just in terms of the amount of weaponry, I mean, Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby said today that more than half of the 90 howitzers that were being sent to Ukraine in the last two aid packages are now already in Ukraine. I mean, given the distances involved for howitzer crossing the Ukrainian border to get to the front lines for use, I mean, how quickly do you think they can be brought to bear?
It's not going to be tomorrow, Anderson. I'll say that right now. You know, when you're talking about the fielding of equipment inside of a combat zone, if you have one spot where you're delivering all those pieces of equipment, it's relatively easy to transport the weapons to that one spot. But what we're talking about now is a frontage along the Donbas region that's anywhere from 150 to 200 miles wide. So they have to get those artillery pieces and the related ammunition to the key areas where the Ukrainian forces can conduct counterfire against the Russian artillery. That's going to take a while. In addition to that, the Ukrainian forces have to train on the artillery as well to make sure that they use it correctly.
General Mark Hertling, really appreciate it. Thank you. Always interesting. Up next, we first met a young woman named Anastasia as she was fleeing from Kharkiv with her family. Coming up, she joins us again for an update on where she and her family are now and how she's trying to help the Ukrainian forces fight for her homeland. Today marks the beginning of the 10th week of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. These last couple of months have been difficult, certainly for Ukrainians, with the latest data from the United Nations showing more than 5.4 million people have fled the country and more than 7 million people are displaced internally throughout Ukraine. Last month, Anastasia Paraskevova is someone that we met who created video diaries of her time in Kharkiv, less than 30 miles from the Russian border, showing us the reality of living through the war. Here's just a snippet from her stories back then.
Last night was probably the most terrifying night of my life. Kharkiv was terribly bombarded last night. Airstrikes all over the city. Dozens of buildings destroyed. Civilian buildings where people live.
Well, I spoke to her again with Anastasia earlier today. She shelters miles away from Kharkiv. Anastasia, the last time we spoke, you had left Kharkiv, but you hadn't found a place to stay yet. How are you? How are you and your mom and your sister doing?
We're doing as fine as you can be. We're in Poltava. A friend of ours who he lent us his home to live in without pay, without anything. So we are staying while he is fighting. So we have a relatively secure place to live.
Do you feel safe?
Well, it's much more safer here in Poltava than it is in Kharkiv, of course. Air raid sirens go off 3-4 times a day. Will fly and kill whoever. It can land in any building. And that's why security is not exactly how I would describe it, but much more secure than you would be in cities, Kharkiv, Mariupol.
Yeah, I mean, the shelling in Kharkiv continues to just be relentless. I know you've been volunteering to help out a local battalion. What are you doing?
This is the battalion of the guy who lent us his place. His name is Yuri. He is fighting in a local battalion of Poltava. So I decided to actually thank you very much. I used you as a platform. I appeared in your CNN program. People found me on Facebook. So I asked them to help this battalion with optical instruments they need and protective gear. And we just bought yesterday 11 monocles. So thank you very much.
I know you were trying to get helmets as well, but they're hard to find.
Yeah, they're really hard to find. It seems that the Ukrainians bought every helmet in existence. They're out of stock. In Germany, they're out of stock. Locally, they're out of stock. And to get them in only big volunteer organizations seems to be able to buy them in large quantities. So it's hard to do this, but there are also battalion needs, such as, for example, optical instruments, because they soon might be sent to a dangerous location in Izum. So the war is going on there, active war zone. So they will need those to patrol to be more secure.
I understand that your dad returned to Kharkiv. How is he doing?
For 2 months, basically now. I would say that he's a bit depressed. It gets to him, I guess, and many other people. So I would call him, he's down, down a bit.
But your apartment is still there?
Yes, it's all right. I asked my friend, Arona is like territorial defense, civilians who took arms. So I asked him if my apartment building is still standing. Every 2-3 days he goes and...
Well, Anastasia, it's good to hear from you again. Please stay safe.
Thank you again. You really helped me a lot.
Just a note, the optical instruments that Anastasia talked about giving to the Ukrainian military are monoculars, which is a single-lens binocular. Coming up, the latest on the recent string of mysterious deaths of Russian businessmen. That's ahead. So at least 6 Russian businessmen have reportedly died by suicide in the last few months, with 3 of them allegedly killing members of their own families before taking their own lives. The first, head of transport at Gazprom Invest, was found dead in his cottage near Leningrad in late January. A month later, another top Gazprom executive was found dead in his garage. 3 days later, it was Ukrainian-born Russian billionaire in England. In late March, another Russian businessman was found dead alongside his wife and children. And earlier this month in Moscow, two more Russian businessmen died in apparent murder-suicides, one of them the former vice president of Gazprom Bank. Now, the other, a former executive at the gas producer Novatek, who was found dead north of Barcelona with his wife's and daughter's bodies nearby. At least four of the men were associated with the Russian state-owned energy giant Gazprom and its subsidiaries. Now, Gazprom has not returned CNN's calls for comment. Stay with CNN throughout the weekend for the latest from Ukraine. The CNN film Navalny starts now.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.